it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. If you have questions and comments you'd like to share with us, just email or visit our Facebook or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansiel, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Investigation Shows Hundreds of U.S. Cops Being Trained by Far-Right Extremists. Here's more. Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published recently to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Reuters identified five law enforcement trainers who have been hired by police and sheriff's departments nationwide despite their support for right-wing militia groups, including the Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and Three Percenters. The QAnon conspiracy, which baselessly claims that Democrats and Hollywood stars belong to a cabal of Satanists, pedophiles, and cannibals, and former President Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Some use bigoted instructional materials that promote racism, misogyny, and many people endorse the constitutional sheriff philosophy, which maintains that country sheriffs should refuse to uphold any law they find unconstitutional. Reuters reported adherence to the constitutional sheriff movement considered the federal government a grave threat to U.S. citizens. They argue that local law enforcement is a higher authority with the power to countermand the decisions of legislatures, courts, and presidents. Richard Whitehead, one of dozens of active and retired police officers or trainers who were listed in a database of members of the Oath Keepers, has called for public executions of government officials he sees as disloyal to Trump, Reuters reported. In a 2020 social media post, he urged cops to disobey COVID-19 public health orders from tyrannical governors, adding, "We are on the brink of civil war." During his day job, the Idaho-based law enforcement consultant has taught at least 560 police officers and other public safety workers in 85 sessions in 12 states over the past 4 years. Noted the news outlet, which analyzed public records from departments that hired him. He is one of the five police trainers identified by Reuters whose political commentary on social media has echoed extremist opinions or who have public ties to far-right figures, the news outlet added. They work for one or more of 35 training firms that advertised at least 10 police or public safety training sessions in 2021. Whitehead, Daryl Schneck, Adam Davis, Tim Kennedy, and Ryan Morris are tapping into a lucrative business opportunity that likely wouldn't exist if U.S. police officers were adequately prepared during their initial job training, Reuters reported. The lessons promoted in their private courses, meanwhile, might be less dangerous for civilians if states had more funding to set standards and provide oversight. As the news outlet explained, private trainers work in an unregulated industry that largely has evaded the heightened scrutiny of U.S. policing in recent years in the wake of high-profile police killings of civilians. Trainers like those identified by Reuters, a half-dozen police training specialists say, highlight a lack of standards and oversight that allows instruction that can often exaggerate the threats that officers face, making them more likely to respond with excessive force in stressful situations. U.S. law enforcement officers receive far less initial training at police academies than their counterparts in comparable countries, said Arjun Sethi, a Georgetown University adjunct law professor and policing specialist. That opens immense commercial opportunities for private trainers to fill the void with ongoing training of active duty officers, often in a politicized manner that normalizes biased policing against Black people and other communities, he said. Private trainers typically advertise their courses to police and sheriff's departments, who often pay for their officers to take them. But individuals can also seek out and pay for courses on their own to satisfy government or department requirements for ongoing training. The courses vary widely in content and in price from hundreds to thousands of dollars per attendee. State-based oversight institutions, often called peace officer standards and training agencies, set requirements for police training, such as the types of classes and minimum teaching hours that officers must complete. But the institutions have little power in most states to influence course content or set standards for private police trainers, in part due to budget constraints, said Randy Strawberry, a former police officer. He saw unregulated police training as such a problem that in 2017, he founded the California-based Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Cops who perceive a far-right trainer as authoritative and credible may end up adopting their ideology, said Strawberry, adding bad training is instilling bad behavior. According to a 2019 analysis of historical FBI data published in the journal Criminology and Public Policy, the number of line duty deaths has declined dramatically over the last 5 decades. Police deaths per 100,000 officers fell by 75% over the past half century, from 81 in 1970 to 20 in 2016. Deaths from felonies decreased even more than accidental deaths during that time. In light of such data showing declining dangers to officers, many training agencies long ago abandoned training that emphasized putting officers through simulations of threatening situations, Reuters reported. That's the worst kind of training to give officers today, to make them to feel more vulnerable, said Jill Carl Lewowski, who led the police departments of Buffalo and Seattle between 1994 and 2009, adding, "You want people to have an awareness of violent threats, but you don't want them to be so hypersensitive that it impacts everything they do." Although the war on cops thesis is not supported by any evidence, as the 2019 study concluded, individual trainers have wide latitude to teach America's police officers whatever they see fit due to the lack of regulation, Reuters noted. The news outlet added the mindset that trainers impact, such as a feeling of constant vulnerability, can be more influential than the technical knowledge they share, said Thetz Staunton, a law professor at the University of South Carolina and former police officer with expertise in law enforcement training. Staunton said studies show that training which overemphasizes life-threatening situations can impart a warrior mentality, convincing the officers that they face constant deadly threats. In a promotional video that Kennedy released in 2020, Chris Jackson, an officer who works for a California police agency operated by a Native American tribe, said Kennedy's course had opened his eyes to the world and changed the way he would respond to threats. "You never want to be a victim of anything," he said in the video. Jackson told Reuters in an interview that the training, which his agency paid for, made him more aware of potential threats and prepared to respond with less hesitation. He said, "Sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do to eliminate the threats." More than 5,000 people in the United States of America have been shot and killed by cops since 2015, including 1,050 in the past year alone. Police kill civilians in the U.S. at a far higher rate than their counterparts in comparable countries.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the UN Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare. It's economic warfare. And it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takhtaravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
Outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defense Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defense Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defense Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tapping of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside the state institution and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials. And this is being confirmed in the Spanish prime minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation. And this revelation of the Spanish prime minister is just another example of that.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a backdoor as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analyzed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers, and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with the spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the U.S. blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on U.S. national security interests. An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
The Pentagon says it's training Ukrainian troops in Germany and other locations in Europe, an announcement that's likely to anger Russia. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Germany is one of the roughly three locations where over 100 Ukrainian troops are being trained on operating howitzer artillery systems and radars. The troops are set to go back to Ukraine and provide a training to others on how to operate the systems that the United States has recently pledged to the country. Kirby also says the United States is considering training Ukrainian troops on how to use other equipment in a virtual format. The White House has recently called on Congress to provide $33 billion in additional assistance to Ukraine, some two-thirds of which earmarked for military purposes. Washington has already sent millions of dollars worth of weapons and equipment to Ukraine. That's on top of the aid packages other NATO allies have allocated to Kiev.
At a war between these two great superpowers, the U.S. and Russia, would be absolutely disastrous for the entire world with the threat of nuclear war. But in practicality, absolutely, it does mean that. It does mean that just as we have in Syria, where the U.S. will train extremist fighters, the U.S. is functionally at war with the Syrian government and the Syrian people, though perhaps not literally on paper. I think the same thing applies to Ukraine. If the U.S. is going to fund and now actively train people to fight against Russia's special operation in Ukraine, then the U.S. is functionally at war.
Russia has earlier warned that weapons poured into Ukraine from the West will be fair game for its strikes. The United States and other NATO member states had initially said they didn't want to enter into a direct conflict with Russia. Is that the reason why they're helping prolong the war in Ukraine, which in effect is likely to turn into a proxy conflict? On May 1st, Adam Kinzinger, a Republican congressman representing Illinois' 16th congressional district,
introduced a resolution dubbed Authorization for Use of Military Force to Defend America's Allies, or AUMF. If passed, the resolution would enable U.S. President Joe Biden to use his war powers against Russia in case Moscow carries out a chemical or nuclear strike in Ukraine. But in the event of a war, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. That could explain why both have ruled out the possibility of a direct confrontation. It can also be the reason why the West has resorted to imposing sanctions on Russia and providing Ukraine with assistance. One such example is the spy satellites belonging to the U.S. military and private firms that are gathering intel on Russian military positions and movements in Ukraine and relaying them to the U.S. and its allies, including Kiev itself.
I mean, if there's anything that we learned from the 90s, it's that when NATO gets involved in a war, it is disastrous for the civilians more than anyone else. We saw that in Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, it looks like we may see that again in Ukraine. And if NATO were to become involved, if NATO were to declare war on Russia or even amp up its support for Ukraine, be it money, weaponry, training, whatever it may be, it will be disastrous. And it will make this conflict become more prolonged, which is, I'm sure, what Lockheed Martin and Boeing and the other big corporations in the U.S. military-industrial complex want.
These developments are pushing the tensions to the point of no return. What's certain is that a possible war between superpowers won't have a winning side.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Thankfully, the Islamic Republic is an attractive model for those who are in contact with us and who are well informed. Therefore, the criteria must be considered. Those who want to make judgments about the condition of the country should not only look at the economy. The economy is only one criterion. There are other criteria as well, such as security, scientific achievements, maximum use of the sanctions for innovating the country and diplomatic indicators. These are all indicators and criteria, and they must be looked at. The power of a country is a system comprised of various elements which are interconnected. Failure to see this geometrical form of power and credibility makes one form wrong judgments. Therefore, the entire system must be seen. When one looks at the system in its entirety, it is satisfactory. Of course, the enemy has certain greedy intentions. He makes some nonsensical and discouraging comments. They used to make such comments before as well. But they are voicing the same statements today, too.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the beginning of the revolution, when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, he held an interview in the proximity of Abudis, near the Iran border. He said the next interview will be held next week in Tehran. He said this. He promised himself and his audience that they would conquer Tehran the following week, where he would hold an interview. And you saw what happened to him during and after the war. In one of the operations, Saddam Hussein was very close to being arrested by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps youth. During Fathul Mubin operation, if they had gotten there half an hour earlier, they would have arrested Saddam. But he took off. He was lucky. In the end, too, he suffered a miserable fate and was forced to accept Iran's terms. And later on, he even sought refuge in Iran. Sent his planes one after another without our permission in subsequent events.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Elad, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Elad is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hail the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Elad operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Casting their ballots before heading out to work. Britons having their say in an election that'll send thousands of representatives, conservative, labor, or liberal Democrat, to local councils.
This election, though, is not just about bin collections, access to hospitals and libraries, or the state of the roads. The fallout from the Partygate scandal and the cost of living crisis is looming large.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized for COVID lockdown violations on his watch and acknowledged his government could do more to ease the blow to the public purse from soaring prices. But many, among them his party members, still want him gone, with a recent survey predicting heavy losses for the Conservatives.
Partygate is a big thing. I mean, Boris just lied through his teeth, and I find it really disgusting the way he's behaved, actually.
It's mostly down to the Conservatives, Boris Johnson over-promising, under-delivering, lying his way through. The recent Ukrainian refugees and Afghan refugees, where they promised to do so much and haven't done anything at all.
He has very little credibility. He's lied to Parliament, he's lied to the nation.
Main challenger Labour have been consistently leading in national polls for the past few months, but that might not translate into gains. Whether it's down to Brexit, COVID, or personality, Labour's new leader, Keir Starmer, is yet to reconnect with a large part of the country that deserted his party and voted Conservative in the 2019 general election.
They may make some gains, but I think that will be in spite of Sir Keir Starmer rather than because of him. And I think it really will be a reaction to the very poor way in which the Conservative government has actually been leading the country.
It won't be long before the results come out. And if the predictions turn out to have been right, then experts say it might be curtains for the Prime Minister. Saeed Porza, London.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a 2-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new lockdowns is very much premature. I'd rather focus on diversifying Italy's energy supply sources and tackling unemployment, which is likely to soar significantly in autumn.
The National Association of Entrepreneurs Confindustria has recently said Italy's economy is heading for recession, which is defined by 2 consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth. Last month, the Italian government revised down its 2022 economic growth forecast to 3.1% from a 4.7% projection made last September, a forecast considered optimistic by most independent bodies. Economists have warned that surging food and energy prices will seriously affect Italians' spending power, leading to an excruciating decline in domestic demand. It is also estimated that 500,000 workers are expected to lose their job should Italy completely halt its gas supplies from Russia.
Giving up the Russian supplies will be a catastrophe for the European manufacturer, and for Italy this would be managed only through a profound alteration of the democratic rules.
Last year, Italy had recorded a strong recovery from its economic contraction of nearly 9% in 2020 due to the restrictions adopted to counter the COVID crisis. That recovery has been cancelled by the measures undertaken to sanction Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civili, Rome.
The family of an Iranian citizen on trial in Sweden has released shocking allegations of mistreatment as they continue to fight a lengthy legal battle for his release. Hamid Nouri was arrested at Stockholm Airport in 2019. Charges brought against him include human rights abuses against prisoners dating back to 1988. Nouri's wife told Press TV that he'd been held in solitary confinement, physically assaulted by prison staff, and subjected to mental torture. Nouri and his family deny all allegations. His detention has been branded illegal by Tehran.
Not only has the trial been condemned by Iranian authorities as unlawful, but also the treatment of the family of the accused. Shocking footage of Nouri's family being harassed has deepened Iranian anger at the Swedish authorities for their poor handling of the case.
Nouri's family have been in and out of court all week. Every time they arrive, supporters of a notorious anti-Iran terror group, MKO, harass and threaten them. The Swedish authorities are slow to respond. Away from the protesters, V spoke to a local Iranian eyewitness who saw this disgraceful behaviour.
It was just really, really sad for me to see an old woman walking up to the stairs to the court and hearing a bunch of words, which actually I'm ashamed even to think about it, not even bring it to my mouth, to even think about it. But this group are known, as I said. We know those people exactly how they are. We know those people from the time which they was killing Iranian soldiers during the war with Iraq. We know those people when they was I would love to say, leaking Saudi regime's shoes for getting a bunch of dollar or money or whatever, or support from a terrorist regime, as American regime. I really would like to know what's going on for about Sweden, actually. Sweden, a country which always talk about human rights and freedom and democracy, now are supporting and making a favor and show for a group which they have been in years in a terrorist list for whole world, international terrorist list.
The accusations against Nouri are mostly taken from members of this same group. The MKO has been accused of fabricating atrocities multiple times, again raising questions about the credibility of the prosecution, who wish to see Nouri sentenced to life. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Hundreds of civil servants inside the European Commission are working on a sixth round of sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. More Russian individuals, banks and media outlets are being targeted. There is also a proposal to completely stop the importation of Russian oil into the 27-country EU. Legislators say the measures will not only hurt Russia.
They will also affect the lives of European citizens with a direct impact on their homes, their jobs, their wallets.
A debate on Wednesday in the European Parliament heard that inflation in the EU is eating up wages and pensions. Apparently 36 million people in the bloc are unable to sufficiently heat their homes.
We should not talk about energy poverty anymore. We are talking about actual poverty. People who cannot pay their bills anymore. And therefore, my proposal is to organise a social summit.
The new social crisis and Ukrainian refugee crisis are placing additional pressures on EU health systems, including mental health services. Those working in the sector say there is not enough financial support from governments.
I have a lot of colleagues, they are leaving, they don't want to work as a nurse anymore because the pressure is too high. And because if you have a lot of people inside the houses that cannot pay the rent, they cannot afford to pay food, they cannot pay the gas and electricity, of course, they are going to have mental issues.
Pope Francis says NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's door may have caused the conflict in Ukraine. Some EU lawmakers agree and suggest Washington is mostly to blame.
The US needs the war to reinforce the unipolar power, while Ukraine, the people of Europe, and hundreds of millions in the global south will pay the price.
The European Commission's latest sanctions on Russia are presently just proposals.
Ban all Russian oil.
Hungary and Slovakia look set to veto the oil ban. There is growing concern surrounding how the Kremlin might respond to such a ban.
That's because Russia's gas is even more important to the EU's economy than its oil. Economists say if Moscow was to switch off the gas immediately, it would be game over for the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Monday, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, announced Italy's employment rate reached almost 60% in March, with more than 23 million people in work. The figure is the highest since 2004, when the agency started to keep track of such records. This as the country's economy is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic amid serious concerns over increasing energy prices. Some trade unions have expressed skepticism about the way the data is gathered by the Bureau of Statistics.
The increase in the number of employed people should be evaluated with great caution, as in most cases it's temporary or petty jobs. Employment figures are made to look impressive, to show that the economy has picked up again, but the reality is very much different. Over time, insecure work has become prevalent in Italy, and workers are being blackmailed into accepting longer working hours and low wages.
Another point to consider is the definition of an employed person. For the majority of Western countries' statistical agency, working just 1 hour a week would be enough to be classified as an employed individual. Another report carried out by research institute Censis and trade union UGL shows that Italian salaries fell by over 8% in real terms between 2010 and 2020. The report has also highlighted the problem of in-work poverty in Italy.
Wages are really low, long working hours. It's difficult, very difficult.
Lo dico io personalmente perché...
Who better than me can tell you how hard it is to find a job? I've been looking for work for a year. The only time I found something, I was paid badly and off the books.
Over